After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Welcome to the Real Change series on the Metta Hour with Sharon Salzberg. Inspired by Sharon's newest book, Real Change, this series features conversations with activists, artists, and teachers, all discussing the intersection of meditation and social action. To learn more, visit realchangebook.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm speaking today with Killian Ngo for the Real Change podcast series. Killian is the founding director of Recovery Cafe, providing a beautiful, safe, warm, drug and alcohol-free space and a loving community to anchor members in the sustained recovery needed to gain and maintain access to housing, social and health services, healthy relationships, education, and employment. Can't remember the year I visited Recovery Cafe in Seattle, but I was so moved by being there. Before starting Recovery Cafe in 2004 with Ruby Takushi, Killian co-founded Samaritan Inns, a nonprofit in Washington, D.C., which provides transitional and longer-term drug and alcohol-free community-oriented housing for individuals recovering from homelessness, addiction, and other mental health challenges. She has written about Samaritan Inns and Finding Our Way Home, and about Recovery Cafe in Descent into Love. Killian is passionate about authentic community and its power to transform. Welcome to the Metta Hour, Killian.
Thank you so much, Sharon. I have such fond memories of your visit and of your kind presence. That's what I remember.
Thank you so much. I mean, I was really, I was very moved by being there. I wished that for the moment that I lived in Seattle so that I could actually have a longer term relationship with the place. So this recording is part of a larger series of conversations on the Metta Hour, which are centered around the themes in my book, Real Change, Mindfulness to Heal Ourselves and the World. And, you know, I've long held the question for myself, what's the role of mindfulness and loving kindness, or one might say love, in changing the world? And the book in many ways is the culmination of that question. So I look to activists and social change agents in a variety of fields, such as yourself. And so I find your work very, very inspiring. To begin with, can you tell us a little bit about how you came to your path?
Sure. I grew up in the mountains of North Carolina. My dad was a pastor. I experienced being part of a very loving community. But I also experienced a lot of clear answers to questions in that community. And I found myself drawn to mystery and paradox. And so when I went away to college, I once again found myself drawn to an African-American church and to the sermons the themes on exile and speaking truth to power, those themes awakened a sense of urgency in me. And immediately after I graduated from college, I volunteered to work in the Middle East. And once again, I found myself drawn to not only individuals who were different from the small community I grew up in the mountains of North Carolina, but I found myself drawn to learning about the faith experiences of people from different religions. And eventually, 3 years after time in the Middle East, I ended up back in Washington, D.C., and I was a part of a faith community there that was committed to the path of contemplation and action as being two sides of the same coin. We talked about it as the inward and the outward journey. And I guess what we practiced most in that community was that if we take seriously this inward journey, which you've given your life to, then we will also be able to discover some place in the world to offer our gifts, some place of suffering and need in the world, and that those two things are two sides of the same coin.
That's very beautiful. You started the Recovery Cafe in 1999, and since then it has grown to have 22 cafes in 11 states, the District of Columbia, and Canada. So that's a real testament to the model you've implemented, which is referred to by the larger behavioral health community as a recovery-oriented system of care, ROSC. Can you explain what that is?
Well, I would say that what is unique about our Recovery Cafe community is we are a membership organization. People choose to be part of the community, and they commit to three practices as members of the community. They commit to being drug and alcohol free for at least 24 hours before entering the space as a way of honoring the journey that everyone is on and in the community, and that honoring that people have different needs for refuge. And the second practice or commitment is that everyone will be a contributor. You know, in a lot of really awesome social service agencies, people come to the agency to receive services. And of course, that's thank goodness that those agencies are there to offer those services. But in this Recovery Cafe community, people come not just to receive services, but to offer support to others. So they come to contribute, not just to receive, but to contribute. So the second commitment is that all members will be contributors to the healing of others. And literally just to running the cafe. So, you know, there's a lot of work to putting out two really nutritious meals a day. And so everyone, you know, commits to helping with the physical work as well. And then the third commitment that everyone makes, all members make, is to participate in this small, loving accountability group. It really becomes our spiritual family. You know, what we talk a lot about is that all of us have a deep need to be both known and loved. And a lot of us maybe were known by people growing up who weren't particularly skilled at loving us, and so to be known without being loved is a terrifying thing. Or maybe we've been loved by people who didn't truly know us, and that experience is a somewhat superficial thing. But in these recovery circles, we really value being both deeply known and deeply loved by the same core group of people. And we find that there is something very powerful and healing about those two things going together.
So is that a recovery-orientated system of care?
I would say that we don't fit perfectly into any category.
That's good too. That's probably better.
So I would say some people in the larger recovery world, recovery. When I say recovery, I mean recovery from mental health and substance use. A lot of people in professionals in that world have called us that, but I would say that we really don't fit in any particular category that well. And another reason why we don't, Sharon, is we don't fit very well in any category is that we emphasize how all of us are in recovery from many things. Mm-hmm. And so whereas in insurance companies would like to keep put you in little boxes so they know how to, you know, be reimbursed for services, but we actually try not to fit into little boxes, and we try to remind all of us who are members of this community that this journey we're on is a journey of recovery from so many things, and that the more we uncover, the more we recover, the deeper we go, the more we discover the need recovery from something else that maybe we didn't realize we needed recovery from.
Well, I love every element of what you described, and starting with contributing, you know, and not only receiving. I mean, it's very difficult to receive too. It's its own practice, really. But I think something else happens when it feels more reciprocal or more mutual. Like, I can remember a friend of mine who was in a psychiatric hospital for a long, long, long stay, kind of unusual in this day and age. And when he got out and was to some extent resuming his life and to some extent remaking his life, one of the things that he did was he volunteered in this kind of like a soup kitchen. And he was taking a lot of psychotropic medications. Hands were shaking. And first they had him cutting sandwiches. And then they thought, well, this is dangerous, you know. So then they had him wrapping sandwiches. And he got such immense satisfaction out of doing that. You know, the food was going to some homebound people who were ill. And he wasn't enjoying his previous level of stature and, you know, whatever. And it actually didn't matter because it was such a pure sense of, even in what seems to be a small way, making a difference. And if we don't, any of us, do those small things, seemingly small things, nothing's going to happen.
I totally agree. Your story, beautiful story, reminds me of one of our members who has now has years of really deep recovery, but he likes to remind us of the very first day he walked into Recovery Cafe, and he said, "You didn't even wait till day two before handing me a broom and telling me to sweep the kitchen." And he said, "Actually, even though I was a little surprised," he said, "it was the first time that I felt some sense of worth in as long as I could remember. Having done that job, it was the first." So we all want to be contributors. And of course, one of the things that happens at Recovery Cafe is as people attain some stability in their mental health, in their recovery from substance use disorder, people discover that they have so many other gifts, so many other ways of contributing, ways that they never imagined before. One of my favorite stories is a woman who had suffered from hearing voices for most of her adult life. And we have a very strong yoga program at Recovery Cafe. And so she began taking yoga classes, and she realized that the yoga classes helped still the voices. And as she healed and became her recovery, attained some stability, the yoga instructor offered to put her through a course of becoming a yoga teacher herself. It was amazing. And of course, that is one of the programs. He has since taken many of our members through that that instruction of becoming yoga teachers. But when she completed that course work and was a certified yoga instructor, guess what she ended up doing?
Teaching at Recovery Cafe?
Well, a lot of our members who have gone through that coursework do teach at Recovery Cafe. But she ended up teaching at a local psychiatric clinic, a yoga class for individuals who suffered from hearing voices.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so the idea that we all have gifts to share, and that sometimes what we offer, the gift that we offer and that brings us so much joy in offering, is somehow related to our own struggle.
Mm-hmm. It's the most authentic teaching there is, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I'm glad you said that about the yoga class, because I was going to ask you if that recovery group is the only required kind of activity, what else happens there that's optional or is available for people?
Oh, yeah, good question. Well, we have school for recovery, and in the school there is a wide variety of classes, and there are classes like the yoga classes, there are writing classes, art classes, even theater and singing and meditation and classes that are more practical, like resume writing and budgeting and nutrition. And so there are many, many classes that people can take advantage of as they continue to grow and then become teachers in some of those classes, or co-teachers in some of our cafes. In one of our cafes in San Jose, California, every class is co-facilitated by a member of the cafe. I think that's a great idea.
It's a wonderful idea. I mean, in a way, you know, society and probably families and one's own mind, you know, all weave a story about who we are and who we might yet become. And you're telling a different story, you know. To quote Jon Kabat-Zinn, who said, you know, if you're breathing, there's more right with you than wrong with you.
I love that.
You know, so even in a life that in a way has fallen apart, or, you know, there've been a lot of consequences from drinking or drug use, there's still that sense of potential, capacity, possibility that can be very alive.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
So is it all closed down now in the, well, from the kind of upsurge in the pandemic, did the cafe close?
We have, for a period of time, we had to close the part of our work, which is the hanging out together in a cafe setting. And that's a very important part of our work. And we did have to close that down to keep people safe. But what that allowed us to do was dream of new ways to connect with our members and new ways to love our members. So now we are welcoming people back into the cafe, observing the social distancing rules and the wearing of masks. And so we're having recovery circles again inside the building. But for a period of time, what we learned how to do by necessity is connect with people through what we're now calling teleconnection, and that is through phone calls. We purchased phones and were able to get phones to all of our members who didn't have a way of connecting via phone. And we were able to teach people how to use Zoom recovery, Zoom circles or Zoom platform for recovery circles. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty amazing. And we have two cafes in Seattle. One of the buildings, our largest building in Seattle, we turned over completely for a time, and it's still in the hands of our county, King County. We turned it over to be used as an enhanced shelter for people most at risk of dying of the virus. So that continues to be, that building continues to be used in a new way. And as we've learned so much about teleconnection and connecting over Zoom circles and through the phone calling, that will continue long after the virus has passed, because it actually enhances our ability to connect with our members and with each other.
That's really fantastic. And it's fantastic that you provided the phones. I remember a conversation I had. I did a program for this organization once, and kind of stress reduction meditation tips, you know, and they felt that this was quite some years ago too. And they felt that people would not necessarily, and the people they were working with, who were like, you know, farm workers in California and then domestic workers, you know, home health aides and people like that. They felt like people were not going to all have smartphones, you know, and so the whole delivery was over text of these very short, but several guided meditations. And other people may have disagreed, and I don't know how the tech thing will actually evolve, but it's kind of inspiring to me to see that people are finding a way.
Yes, it's been challenging, and yet it has been gratifying to find new ways. Like, for example, we served 2 meals a day before COVID. Now we serve 2 takeout meals a day. Mm-hmm. Because of not being able to gather in the same way, and not being able to gather safely. So innovation, it's been necessary.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when before masks were, certainly before they were mandated in a lot of places, and before they were even highly recommended, I'm here in Barre, Massachusetts. I don't go anywhere. You know, and I watched this whole industry of mask makers arise.
Yeah.
I started buying a lot of masks online, both it was something to buy. But I just had so much admiration. You know, you can get a mask that says, be mindful, or you can get a mask that says, be kind to everyone, or you can get,
yeah.
You know. I mean, and I thought, well, there's some resilient spirit, you know, like it just arose.
Yep.
So how do you strike a balance in your own life? I mean, I remember just the day I was there in the recovery cafe, how poignant it was. And one of your members had died, and dealing with sort of the grief of everybody and your own. And also the beauty, which is in these people, which may be so overlooked by most people. And there you are witnessing it. And how do you find some balance?
Well, I'll be honest. It's been harder during this COVID-19 period to find that balance. Personally, I'm spending a lot more time on these Zoom calls. Yeah. And something about, I'm grateful for Zoom. Don't get me wrong. I'm grateful for all these ways of connecting. But it doesn't feed me the way being face-to-face with someone does. And so I have found that it exhausts me in a different way, and so one way that I, you know, have for years sought to stay grounded and to have some balance is through a my centering prayer, my contemplative practice.
Mm-hmm.
So that daily practice is, I'm finding it's always been important, but I'm finding it's more important than ever. And then I find that movement, for me, physical movement is really important. I'm grateful that I can walk and And I do. I get out and I walk, you know, a lot every day. Something about the movement really helps me stay grounded. I also find that being in a recovery circle myself, where I am both deeply known and loved, is very grounding and helps me stay balanced. And I guess this gets a little bit into the subject of boundaries, but I also think it's really important to remember that no one person is needed by everybody. That, you know, we often say at Recovery Cafe, everyone is deeply known, but not everyone is deeply known by everybody, but everyone is deeply known by somebody this small group of people. So it helps me stay balanced to remember that everyone has a small group where they are being carried. I don't need to carry everybody. And that's not only true, it's very true that I don't need to carry everybody, but it's also, even if there's that temptation to think, oh, well, this particular person really needs me and only me. I even find that's often not the case, because if I need to pull back a little bit, I find that it creates some space for someone else to lean in a little bit. And so I guess what I'm getting at is community. Community is what helps me stay balanced, because community does not depend on one individual. It depends on many individuals leaning in.
That's a really beautiful and sort of different response. Like a lot of people would say and do say, I couldn't stand just the stimulation of the community anymore. You know, it was like altogether too much. And it's quite beautiful to think of that's the reassurance. That's actually the safety measure, that it's not just up to me. And we can allow ourselves to get a break or get some rest or just enjoy something. I mean, I have this part of my book about an activist friend of mine who he was brilliant. He was one of the first people doing that kind of work I'd ever met. And he was also phenomenally depressed. It's not the same person. It's a different person than I was talking about before. And I don't know. It's such a complex topic. But there was also a part of him that didn't feel it was okay to enjoy anything. And that there was too much pain in the world. He sort of didn't deserve, you know, the enjoyment. And yet the exhaustion of that is also very apparent. And, you know, that sense of looking for the joy, looking for like the joy in a community. And I would bet there's a lot of laughter sometimes in those groups, you know, and
yes.
It's not something we should feel guilty about. It's not the same as, you know, the world saying only seek pleasure and avoid pain and cast aside anybody else who looks like they're in pain. It's really not that at all.
No, I agree, Sharon. In fact, I would say that deep joy and deep suffering are often two sides of the same coin. That if we're just trying to avoid a person, a person, another person's pain, that doesn't really bring us joy. But when we enter fully into that other person's reality and we come to see the whole person and the part of that individual, as you said, who can laugh and who can not take themselves too seriously, there is just real joy. There's joy in that.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So I'm imagining like a range of feeling in a recovery group. The laughter, the relief, finding one another, maybe a lot of anger, a lot of grieving.
Mm-hmm.
Often a lot of loss has, you know, been experienced. And it just feels like everything.
Yes. You know, definitely everything. There was in my recovery circle, a woman recently lost her mother. Her mother died, and she shared, you know, I always believed the narrative that if my mother died, I would not be able to carry on. I would not be able to continue this recovery journey that I'm on. And that was what I believed. But she said, now I realize that I have this deep grounding and I have this place of being held by others. And I realized that that narrative is just not true, that I am carrying on. And there was just a lot of joy in her discovery of that. So right smack in the middle of her worst pain of losing her mother, there was this joy in the discovery that she had resources and the tools to access those resources and the support of others that she needed. And we all laughed. We all were not laughed at her, but we laughed with her. Mm-hmm. At the sort of rewriting of the narrative.
Now, I'm curious in a way about how, just mechanically, how this works, because people can just drop in, right? But if you join a group, is it always the same group or do people move in and out?
People can come into the community for the meals and the classes and the gathering space when, you know, pre-COVID and after COVID. But the circles, the recovery circles, in order for people to be deeply known and loved in those circles, we try to discourage much movement from one circle to the other, so that that deep bonding can take place and that deep knowing can take place.
And what if a person slips and starts using something again? And then they are clean for 24 hours or sober for 24 hours and they come back. Because that's really, in a way, part of the most important principle of recovery, right? Is being welcomed back, you know?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that touches me about our community is not only are people welcomed back, they are welcomed back, and then we members of the community ask them, tell us what you learned. Mm. Tell us what you learned through this recent experience, because your wisdom will help all of us. So it, far from shaming people, we actually honor their experience.
That's really wonderful. And would you say that there's a, I don't know, I guess it's always different, but I'm wondering about if there's sort of a thread of a predominant emotion like anger or sadness that tends to run throughout, or is it just always changing?
Well, I think everybody wrestles with different powerful emotions, but some of the ones that we experience a lot in this journey, this healing from trauma, and most 9 out of 10 of our members have suffered some childhood trauma. Mm-hmm. And so some of the really strong emotions that we experience a lot with people are anger and shame, mm-hmm. and fear, and even blame. Mm-hmm. And again, all of those emotions are not bad. They just are emotions that have to be worked with. They're not bad emotions.
Yeah, one of the things I try to do in teaching meditation is suggest that if you're feeling anger or shame or, you know, jealousy or something like that, instead of calling those feelings bad or wrong or I'm a bad or weak person, actually do a translation in your mind to this is a painful state, you know?
Right, right.
It really hurts. This is a lot of suffering being kind of locked into this.
Yes, that's what I mean by not judging the emotions, but maybe even viewing them as a gateway to the healing that is needed.
Do you have a definition of compassion that you use?
I don't know that I have one definition, but I think of compassion as just full acceptance. We live in a culture where we don't often encounter full acceptance, and as a result, I think a lot of us don't fully accept ourselves. We're not very good at fully accepting ourselves. So when I think of compassion for myself, which is probably not my strongest gift, it's where I struggle. But when I think of it, I think of it as to be fully accepted in just as I am. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I want to offer others, to fully accept others just as they are. And not just to accept, but to delight in others just as they are, before they've made all the changes that they want to make or before they've gotten it all together, to delight in people and ourselves just as we are, wherever we are on this journey. I guess that's my definition of compassion.
That's really beautiful. And, you know, of course, we have different experiences in life. Some people grew up in families where that actually was happening. And many, many people did not, or people are having kind of the issues with society where society has declared them to be, a dominant society has declared them to be unworthy or, you know, too different or whatever it might be. And then, you know, there are just so many ways in which we don't, generally speaking, encounter that kind of acceptance and certainly don't incorporate it. You know, it's not reflected to us. And so we don't build that resource inside of ourselves just naturally. It takes, I think, a conscious intentionality of like, I'm going to seek this change and I'm going to try these tools.
Yeah. And what I've discovered is if someone is saying to me, change, 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 I'm not as likely to grow or change. But if someone says, I delight in you just as you are before you change, then somehow that allows for the change to happen. It's a paradox.
One of many, but I think it's very true. So to close our conversation, I would love for you to lead us in some kind of practice.
Oh, thank you, Sharon. Well, I could talk to you for hours. That went by so quickly.
I know. We'll have to do this again. I hate to say we'll Zoom, but, you know, we might.
I appreciate Zoom. The practice that I've been thinking a lot about lately, and it's kind of related to some of our conversation, is it's called the welcoming practice. It's part of the contemplative tradition and I don't know if you've ever taught with Cynthia Bourgeau or
no, I have not, but I know who she is.
You know who she is. So her contemplative society is probably the place where I learned this practice. And it's very simple. So I would invite anyone listening to walk with us in these steps. The first step is just to identify a feeling that you may be having or have had recently that it could be any feeling. It could be a happy feeling or a sad feeling, a feeling that is causing you suffering. But identify that feeling and try to identify where in your body do you sense that feeling? Now, for some, that's really easy to do. But for me, that is something I have not been really great at, and that is identifying the feelings in my body. But I'm learning that. And then once you identify that feeling, whatever it is, intentionally welcome that sensation. Welcome that feeling. Very intentionally say, welcome pain, welcome frustration, welcome anger that I'm sensing in my chest, or welcome the excitement that I'm sensing, and then sit with that. Just sit with that feeling. And then the third simple step is to surrender the feeling, to let go of the feeling. We don't have to rush that, but surrendering the feeling, as Cynthia Bourgeau would say, it helps us to allow the feeling to pass and then gives us the opportunity to make a choice of what we would like to do, what right action would we like to take that gave rise to that feeling. So, for example, if the feeling is anger and we let go of it, then we're in a better place to determine what action do I want to take about that feeling than we are if we're still in the grip of it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what in the contemplative tradition, the contemplative Christian tradition, we would call the welcoming practice.
That's really helpful. I have a Tibetan Buddhist teacher who, in a kind of similar vein, calls it the handshake practice, you know, handshake that difficult emotion or that wonderful emotion that's arising and welcome it into your house. Don't necessarily let it take over. That's not the point, you know, but your awareness, your heartfulness is bigger actually than that emotion, however intense it might feel. And we have the capacity to be very different with this whole range of feelings. So it was a very nice expression of that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me today. And all of you, thank you for listening. And to learn more about Killian's work with Recovery Cafe, you can visit www.recoverycafenetwork.org. This has been the Real Change series on the Metta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, and may you live with ease.
Thank you, Sharon.
Hey folks, thanks for listening. Real Change is available September 1st in hardcover, ebook, and audiobook formats. Learn more at realchangebook.com.